Hello and welcome to the Spectator podcast. I'm Laura Prendergast, and on this week's episode, we'll be reflecting on the tragic events in Manchester and what can be done to prevent similar attacks in the future. We'll also be looking at the emergence of political courts in America, Russia, France and beyond, and we'll be tipping which constituencies to have a flutter on in next month's election. Even after all these years, all these attacks and all these dead, the West still keeps asking the same question after events like those of Monday night. Who would do such a thing? But as Douglas Murray says in this week's issue of The Spectator, terrorists are very clear about what they want. We just aren't listening. I'm now joined by Douglas, whose new book, The Strange Death of Europe, Immigration, Identity and Islam, has just been published, and Haras Rafiq, CEO of Quilliam. So Douglas, what drives someone to go into a crowd of young girls and detonate a bomb?
An ideology which, in his mind, would have explained everything. The meaning of life, the meaning of death, God, the universe, everything. And this, as I say in the piece, is one of the most, if not the most profound meeting points in our time, because somebody who believes in those things and with his views meets a group of young women out for a night hearing a pop singer. And the salient point, as it were, I want to bring across in the piece is people like the Manchester bomber say what they think all the time. The people who inspire them say what they think all the time, what they think about women, what they think about Muslims who don't agree with them, what they think about people who aren't Muslims. They say it all the time. But we keep asking this question, who would do such a thing, whilst keeping our fingers in our ears and not wanting to listen to the answer, deliberately not listening to the answer, even when we're told it all the time in the most bloody and brutal tones. And the example I give of that, separate to this, is something that it feels like it was a long time ago. It was only a month ago that there was the act of national mourning in Westminster Abbey when the Dean of Westminster stood up in relation to the Westminster terrorist attacks and said, what would drive somebody to drive a car into a crowd of strangers on Westminster Bridge and then kill a policeman? And the Dean of Westminster said, we may never know. And I say in the piece, we do know. We all knew at the time what Khalid Massoud, the Westminster attacker, was inspired by. If the Dean of Westminster had waited a few more days, he could have come out and said, actually, it turns out we've got the WhatsApp messages and Khalid Massoud said to his mate he's doing it for jihad. But of course, the Dean of Westminster would never get back up in the pulpit and say, oh, I'm terribly sorry, it turns out we do know. Nobody ever says that in our society. We just keep saying, why do they do it? And keep on being weepy mourners at our own funeral. And I think it's high time we change that.
Haras, why do you think people don't want to address this?
I think it's a combination of a number of things. I think it's political correctness. I think it's sometimes ignorance. I think it's sometimes fear of, if they are seen to be saying something that other people don't like, will they be deemed to be xenophobic or hate-based? But I just want to touch on this ignorant point again. Something surreal. I heard something surreal on radio this morning. And I heard the mayor of Manchester, Sheikh Andy Burnham, and I call him Sheikh Andy Burnham, because he almost declared a fatwa this morning, as far as I'm concerned, and he behaved in the same way that ISIS do, in the way that they declare me and people like me as non-Muslims. And he said this morning, Abadi, the murderer, the terrorist who killed 22 people on Monday, my hometown, he declared him a non-Muslim. He said this is not Islam. How dare he say that? Who is he to say to me and to other Muslims and to the wider community that he is somebody who has the knowledge, has the expertise to behave like ISIS, because that's what ISIS are doing. They're killing other Muslims for not being the right kind of Muslim. And to go back to Douglas's point, yes, it's an ideology. I've been doing this for 14 years and I'm sick of it. Enough is enough. This, for me, this is a game changer. You know, my sons work around the corner from the arena. I was there on Monday at 8 o'clock. My daughter could have been going to the concert. And this is you know, I've seen attacks in London, I've seen attacks around the world, and yes, I'm British and I feel for London, but this is my hometown. I'm sick of platitudes, I'm sick of pray for Manchester. We need to tackle this ideology head on, root it out, challenge it, put it to bed, because if we don't, all we're going to see is more and more attacks like this.
What needs to change then?
Well, the first thing is recognising the scale of the challenge, as Harris has just said and has shown the scale of the ideological challenge, and to become serious about that. That's one of the points I try to make in this piece, that we really aren't serious about that. We just have this hermeneutic discussion. And there used to be a tendency after every attack to talk about control orders. Harris, remember this as well. You know, another group of people are killed somewhere, and all the politicians and everyone else go on and they say, well, what can we do to tighten up control orders? And sometimes the person doing it had been under a control order. You know, but it was a thing. Now it's, what should we do in the prevent strategy X, Y, Z? To understand the scale of denial on this, I said this earlier today with Andrew Neil, that to understand the scale of this, consider this. Basically, apart from Quilliam and a couple of other Muslim organisations, I can count on three fingers probably, every single Muslim group in Britain has spent every year recently campaigning against the only counter-extremism policy that the British government has. Okay? The prevent policy I have all sorts of criticisms with, all of us do. But most voluble Muslim community groups in this country not only said they didn't like this bit of it or that bit of it, they said they didn't want such a policy. They don't want such a policy. And Andy Burnham, the mayor of Manchester, when he was campaigning to be mayor of Manchester, campaigned partly to get Muslim votes by saying that he wanted prevent scrapped.
Yeah.
So that's the problem. It's all very well to do the morning pray for Manchester stuff, but I don't want to pray for Manchester. I just want fewer attacks, fewer people killed, fewer pop concerts having to have permanent security and so on around them. And the fact is that we're not serious about this, as shown by the fact that there is no pressure on Andy Burnham or on all of those groups that tour the UK saying we don't want any counter-extremism strategy. There's no pressure on these people. All they get is, as it were, the little uplift from joining in a singing a rendition of Imagine or what was it yesterday in Manchester? Everything's going to be all right. What if it isn't? What if everything ain't going to be all right?
Well, Lutz has got a very, very good point there. In terms of the prevent strategy and this seriousness, you know, there was a recent poll that Policy Exchange conducted. More than half the Muslims in the country actually want a counter-extremism and a counter-terrorism strategy. So why are our politicians not serious? Why are these Muslim groups not serious in getting to grips with it? I'll tell you why. Because a lot of the people in Manchester, my home city, that have access to the politicians, that have access to the police, are part of the problem. They are homophobic. They are anti-Semitic. They create the otherization. They create the victim mentality. ISIS and Al-Qaeda don't radicalize anybody. What they do is tip people over the edge that these other community leaders, and I say that in inverted commas, these community groups who thrive off faith-based identity politics, they create all of this prism. They create this foundation. And ISIS go, thank you very much. And whatever the new flavour is, you know, in next year when ISIS or the year after collapses, there'll be something else unless we get to grips with it. There'll be another acronym. We are getting to a point now that the new normal, if the mayor of London or whoever says, let's get used to it, the normal is that we've got these terrorist attacks, we've got to be in fear of our children, you know, worried about whether they'll be home after a concert or whether they'll be at home, coming home after a football match, etc. If this is the new normal, I don't want to live in a society like this, nor should anybody else.
Douglas, one of the defining things about this attack was the misogyny within it. It's not the first deeply misogynistic thing we've seen. We've had the Rotherham, Rochdale and Oxfordshire grooming scandals. But do you think this attack will make people more aware of the misogyny within Islam?
It will make them more aware of it. It won't necessarily free them up to do anything about that. I hate to delve into the realm of the frivolous, but when this piece went out earlier with this very striking cover image by Morland, Lily Allen immediately tweeted the Daily Mail story about Lexit, Brexit back. And that, I think, I don't want to take Lily Allen as indicative of anything other than her own idiocy, but that sort of, for a while, will continue to be the thing. Oh, yeah, OK, there's a group of guys over there who will carry a nail bomb into a pop concert in the Manchester Arena on a Monday night. On the other hand, Sarah Vine once wrote a piece about the Prime Minister's legs in the Daily Mail, you know, so you've got to sort of weigh it up, haven't you? You know, take your chances, Daily Mail or the Jihadist. I mean, that will, for a while longer, as I see it, continue to be a perfectly acceptable way for a sort of ordinary person to react to this. I think it's pathetic and pusillanimous, and I think the people who do it should be ashamed of themselves. But it's a sort of excuse, escape route for the time being.
Harris, in this week's issue of The Spectator, Jenny McCartney also suggests that Islamists are obsessed with controlling young women. Hmm. Why is that?
Simply control. Islamists feel... Actually, it's not just Islamists. There are, within the text of Islamic scriptures, there are many passages, there are many things that historically people who are Muslims have used to control women. And, you know, it's died down over time for some countries and less so in others. But Islamists really see women as second-class citizens. Islamists see them as servants. Islamists see them as people that are there, human beings that are there to do their bidding. The attack on Monday, the target wasn't necessarily selected off the back of misogyny. That probably had something to do with it. It was a tactical target. It was something that was low risk in terms of one person blowing himself up, creating maximum damage. They said they were going to do it. We knew they were going to do it. Manchester United Football Club have appointed a head of counter-terrorism. We know this is going to happen. We knew it was going to happen. Misogyny is a problem. Of course it is. And, you know, people are getting to grips with that, and they will get to grips with it over time. ISIS really have highlighted for many people how big a problem it is, and they've actually done the rest of the world a bit of a favour by actually exposing some of the interpretations of text. You go to places like Saudi Arabia, women can't drive. Mm. You know, women can't go to work or go out of the house without permission from their mahram, from their guardian. That's not Islamism. That's Salafism. Mm. That's Wahhabism. That's theological. So there's been this problem both within certain interpretations of Islam and especially amongst Islamists.
Just finally, can we just talk about the security threat now? Because the attack in Westminster seemed far more basic than the one in Manchester, which seemed far more sophisticated. What should we make of that?
Well, as I say in the piece, it destroys one of the comforting things that we did have until this, which was the idea that it was not possible for a British-based Islamist to create a viable explosive device of this kind. Mm. We've had also the consolation, thank goodness, to now, and hopefully for the future, the case that it's hard to get Kalashnikov rifles in the UK, and it is easier, of course, sadly, on the continent to do so. But we've had this idea that some of that couldn't happen here. The Manchester Arena attack shows that it is possible. There are people who can do that, and that is a very serious concern. I said after the Westminster attack, in the way, the one consolation we had from it was that this showed people running out of options, using a car and a knife. If that isn't the case, and there are more people out there who can create bombs of this kind, then we've got a problem ahead.
But for me, you know, some things that I've learned from this is that people have still living in denial, as Douglas mentioned. Abadi, the suicide bomber, comes from a family with connections to Islamist organisations, the Libyan Islamic Fighting Group, comes from an environment and an atmosphere where Islamism has been in his upbringing. There have been people who've spotted him. There was an imam at the mosque where he used to go and used to work who wrote a piece in The Guardian, I think it was today, saying that he'd noticed that when the imam had given a sermon about Al-Qaeda, that Abadi reacted in a bad way. Well, why tell us now? Why didn't he do something about it then? You know, there is no such thing as a lone wolf. There is no such thing as somebody who suddenly goes online and decides that he or she wants to become a jihadist. People know, people observe, people see things. This is also an opportunity for the community. And by the way, you don't have to be Muslim to challenge this. Just as you don't have to be gay to challenge homophobia, you can be straight and challenge homophobia. Just as you don't have to be black to challenge apartheid in the past. If you are non-Muslim or if you're Muslim, I don't care. We're British. We have a duty and a right now to step up and become champions in our societies and challenge these people. You see something, do something about it. That's the point we need to get to.
If I may add one thing to that, wholly endorse, of course, what Harris just said, but there is a deep worry. It's one of the things I address in my book. There's a deep worry at the moment about the public and the political class thinking two different things. I very much worry about this in relation to this attack. The political class will be talking about the prevent strategy and so on, but the public will, I think, rightly be wondering, okay, we took this couple in as asylum seekers fleeing Gaddafi's Libya, and how did we get repaid by their son going to Manchester Arena last Monday evening? And you see, this now is going to the root of a very big underlying bubbling problem across our whole continent, which is this fear. What if this is the future? What if even our acts of goodness get repaid in this way? And I'm very worried that if politicians do not start to look further than just the day-to-day on this, we've got a problem coming.
That was Douglas Murray and Haras Rafiq.
Hello, I'm Sam Leith, literary editor of The Spectator, and I present the weekly books podcast, at which you'll hear lively discussions from the best and most interesting critics and writers and authors out there, from Charlotte Rampling to Daniel Dennett, all the way past to Michael Morpurgo. I very much hope you'll give us a try. Just search for Spectator Books on the iTunes store.
Next, on to the rise of the political court. The historian Philip Mansell says we have entered into a new era of political dynasties. I'm now joined by Philip, the author of The Eagle and Splendour, and Ben Judah, author of This Is London and Fragile Empire, to discuss. So, Philip, why are courts returning?
I think it's a very common political form that was dominant till 1914, and people find emotional stability and this political, social, economic capital in dynasties. And it's just common not only in the West, but also in, it was in India, it's coming back in China, in the Stans. Why now? Also because of the death of ideology, the evaporation of socialism, Marxism.
And Ben, you've been in America recently and have seen Trump's court up close. What do you make of that?
I think one of the most interesting distinctions between Trump's court and the Obama administration is that the Obama administration was very cohesive ideologically, and it was a place where an individual like Ben Rhodes could speak for the president, because the whole team around the president had the same views, say, on Iran or on the Iran nuclear deal. But what people find in Washington is that no one speaks for Trump, that you have simultaneously an administration where you have aides like Steve Bannon or Kellyanne Conway, who are household names in a way that hasn't been seen in US politics, arguably since the Clinton years, but I think much earlier. But they can't speak for the president.
And this is a sort of common monarchical trick, to have different voices around you so you can play one off the other and you retain the ultimate choices and decisions.
Trump's court is obviously quite family-based. Is that a more traditional setup of a court?
Yes, people using families as power, and it's these dynasties that helped make Europe, like the House of Orange in the Netherlands or the Prussian royal family in Germany. And Eric Trump has openly defended nepotism. He's saying the people you trust more, therefore they're more useful, which I don't think anyone's openly defended nepotism before in the modern United States.
Certainly not, but the last individual that openly defended nepotism to me was Kermanbek Bakiev, the sort of fallen dictator of Kyrgyzstan. And during a sort of brutal overthrow, which saw him toppled from power, I asked him, like, why had you given your government largely into the hands of your son to be run by him? And he stared at me completely confused and went, because I trusted him absolutely.
Yes.
Which is almost exactly what the Trumps were saying.
Philip, in your piece, you talk about a variety of different courts. You talk about Theresa May and Macron and Trump. But is there anything that unites these courts?
Well, relying on your personal servants more than official government ministers or bureaucracies. The importance of personal emotions that we also saw under Margaret Thatcher. Losing touch with reality or having guardians at the gate who cut you off from conflicting views.
Do they often have similar sort of key figures, such as a kind of intellectual advisor or a court joker kind of figure?
Well, I don't know who's the intellectual advisor of Trump. I don't think there's many intellectuals around him. Yes, they do. They have the consort, who is often very important, and the children, bodyguards, and the person in charge of the message, who was, say, Danon under Napoleon.
But if you look at the differences between some of these courts, I was just in Israel, and the court of Netanyahu operates in quite a distinctive way, in which the prime minister likes to surround himself with young religious Jews from the sort of national religious tradition, which is quite strong in the West Bank settlements, but also beyond, because they don't have deep roots in the Israeli military or in the Israeli sort of super rich class or in any of these institutions which are hostile to Netanyahu. And he likes in particular to also surround himself with young, idealistic, especially American diaspora Jews that, again, don't have deep roots in Israel or can't be played or couldn't betray him, that depend on Netanyahu. If you look at the Macron court, and I got a chance during the campaign to interview Macron, profile him for the Sunday Times, you see a very different kind of role of the consort there, where Brigitte Macron is at least 25% of the politician that is Macron, is distinct from Emmanuel. Around Macron himself, one of the things I found very interesting during the profile was that there was a tendency of Macron to sort of advance through different levels of French society, make very close friends and very close allies, and then just leave them. And that Macron's best friend from school sort of interviewed him, hadn't heard from him in years. Macron's close friends from university were sort of texting and not really sort of receiving much. And Macron's political sort of guardian angels in his earlier years, men like Jacques Attali, had sort of been left behind. And the only constant running through it was Brigitte, the consort.
And Macron is now going to be taken up by the whole machinery of the Élysée Palace, which possibly employs as many as 1,000 people. It's very hard to get correct information. And the glamour of the building, it is a very palatial building with royal and imperial ancestry. And that will probably see him through, as it saw through even Hollande, who was extremely unpopular. And of course, there are people, there are aides-de-camp, military establishment that goes on from president to president.
You mentioned Brigitte, and obviously we've seen Philip May wheeled out a little bit during the election. Is the spousal figure quite an important one in a court?
Yes. Napoleon certainly used Josephine. Louis XIV used different sorts of women. Now, we notice there is no known spouse in Putin's court. It varies, but certainly it's important in France in particular, I think.
Let's talk about the British court for a moment, because that does seem to be slightly different to some of these other courts. I mean, who are the key members in Theresa May's court?
Well, there's the two gatekeepers. There's Fiona Hill and Nick Timothy. And, of course, there was a famous quarrel over Fiona Hill with Gove, which helped decide a lot of things last year. And we don't yet know, I don't think the May court has finally settled into a pattern, as Harold Wilson's or Margaret Thatcher's did. But they will be very important. Another sign of Theresa May is she likes military power, as courts often do. She took the Sovereign's Parade at Sandhurst earlier this year. We'll be seeing a lot more of that, I bet.
One of the distinctions between the May government and watching the Trump administration up close is that multiple members of the Trump administration are cooperating with multiple feature-length profiles on themselves simultaneously, and that you have individuals that claim to hate the liberal media that can't wait to have covers on New York Magazine or The Atlantic written about them. You contrast to here, where, from what I've been picking up in Westminster, is a lot of celebrity politicians are chafing at the bit that they haven't been allowed to bring their PR aides into the government with them, that they're not being allowed to have the profile they had before. So I think that's a kind of very interesting distinction between May and Trump.
There's a famous comment by Horace Walpole, the letter writer in the 1760s, when George III comes to the throne, he says, a new court is a new world, a completely new world. So we're seeing that with Theresa May.
More broadly, a court's generally seen as a good or a bad way to govern.
Well, it depends on the leader, on the monarch in question. They're as varied as every form of government. I don't think they're either particularly good or particularly bad. They can be very effective compared to ordinary bureaucratic machines, which tend to get bogged down. In the end, despite the revolutions of 1848, it was the dynasties and armies of the Hohenzollerns who united Germany and of the Savoys who united Italy. It wasn't, as Bismarck famously said, resolutions or assemblies that did so.
Do voters generally respond better to courts and being able to see who's in power rather than, as you mentioned, the bureaucratic machine?
Not always. There were always some Americans who despised and disliked the Kennedys, I think. The Russian voters do seem to like Putin, though how much that is massaged, I don't know. It's very easy to attach to a recognisable family and dynasty, particularly with a consort and a child. That has never failed to win votes.
Just on Russia, and my first book is a sort of portrait of the Putin years and of the Putin state. It's one of the things that does deeply unnerve the Russian people if you sort of get close to them, is that absence of a familial court around Vladimir Putin. And the mystery of what exactly or where exactly his daughters are, of who exactly they're married to, are they even present in the country, of what exactly happened in his relationship with his previous wife. Often you're asked about that as you travel through sort of Siberia or the heartland regions. And it's a source of a lot of very noxious rumours for Putin, because it's often said or memes spread online that the daughters don't live in Russia because he doesn't believe in Russia, or that there's some sort of weird dysfunction around him, which means that he's not capable of a loving family. And that often is mentioned as one of the ways he's sharply different from Boris Yeltsin, incredibly close to his daughter, who was one of his key policy advisors. Very different in the Russian imagination from Gorbachev. And Gorbachev, with the consort Raisa next to him, used her to briefly re-glamorise the Communist Party and show the nation looking sort of prouder abroad. Or, of course, darling Nicholas the Second,
whose always relationship with his daughters, yes.
Well, and very close to his wife. In terms of consorts that I've seen up close and what sort of influence do they have over politics, Netanyahu is very, very close to Sarah Netanyahu. It's very much a family, it's very much a marriage, very much a love affair. She doesn't have very much influence over policy. She is, however, central to a lot of questions and allegations of corruption that have chased Bibi through the years and seem to be sort of rising to a head. In Washington, there's a sort of interesting take that actually Melania could be the real feminist icon. Not interested in playing the role of First Lady, totally honest about how she wants to use this to advance her brand, not keen to kind of play that role, and that actually if one looks at the role that sort of Michelle Obama was playing, that was far more of a classic subordinate consort than the Trump women.
But the role of the consort shows how courts reappear, however much you want to stamp on them and make them disappear. Madame Mao was very important under de Gaulle. It was said that Madame de Gaulle was far the most important woman in France, far the most influential. And I think it's very interesting what you say about the absence of consort with Putin. I bet if he had a son, we would be seeing a lot more of him and he would be groomed for succession. And I've just been to a brilliant talk at the Society for Court Studies, What Happens When Dynasty Ends, by Natalia Nowakowska, about a Polish dynasty. But it is very unsettling for an entire state, in fact. And I wonder what Putin's strategy is.
The question of the succession has haunted Russian politics for as long as I've been observing it. From who would succeed Yeltsin to the relationship with Medvedev. And the question of the successor is Putin's greatest weakness.
That was Philip Mansell and Ben Judah. Finally, on to betting. In a speculator column in the latest issue of Spectator Money, Freddie Gray offers some advice about how to bet on the current political scene. He joins me now, along with Matthew Shaddock from Ladbrokes. So, Freddie, in your piece you suggest that all of the unpredictability has gone from politics. Has betting become boring?
Well, I think I should start by telling listeners not to do anything I advise. I've got a really bad track record at betting on politics, but I am very enthusiastic about it. I recently predicted that Fillon would win the French presidency and put, by my standards, a very large bet on it. So be warned that I'm not to be listened to. However, I do think that I wouldn't say all the unpredictable politics has gone. I think that would be nonsense. But it does seem in the betting markets, the sort of exciting and likely upsets, if you can have such a thing, are less interesting and seem less possible, particularly with this general election. I mean, despite the Labour rally in recent weeks, I don't think many people seriously think there can be a Labour majority, even though I saw it was 65-1 at one point last week, which is quite tempted the contrarian in me. So I said in this piece, the interesting thing is to look at the nitty-gritty markets, you know, the sort of detailed markets that all betting companies, and Matthew will explain what Ladbrokes do shortly, look at what they do and try and get your value there. Would that be a fair thing to say, do you think, Matthew?
Yeah, I mean, I think in particular, the markets we expect to lose money on, we don't often offer markets we think we're going to lose money on, but on constituency betting and on the individual seats, historically we've always lost money on that. I expect we'll lose money again this year because there are hundreds of them that we're offering odds on. And we're just sat in an office in London looking at numbers, trying to predict what the results are going to be. I really have no idea what's going on in Cambridge or Edinburgh or Cardiff or anywhere else. So if you do know what's going on there, then you've probably got a good shot at making some money by going through all of those seats and having a go at those. That's probably where, you, as a punter, you almost like to make some money. It's where I do most of my betting anyway.
In Freddie's piece, he suggests perhaps the most interesting bet is betting on Theresa's majority. Does that seem wise?
Yeah, sure. I mean, everyone's assuming that the Tories are going to get a majority. The betting markets say there's about a 91% chance they will right now. So you're not going to make a lot of money just by backing the Tories to get most seats or a majority. So if you want to predict exactly where it's going to be. And actually, most people have been a bit more cautious in the last week or so. So the numbers, the betting markets were sort of saying the central projection was about 150 majority about a week ago. Now that's down to about 120. And we'll see when we get some more polls over the weekend whether that's borne out. But it does look like it's going to be a bit closer than people initially expected.
Yeah, I think, I mean, I saw that when I wrote this piece, I saw that a 224 majority was at about 12 or 13 to 1, which seemed completely insane to me. So what I was saying in the piece was that you can actually, if you go slightly lower than that and bet on every single probability, every single tranche of the majority down to about 50 seats, you can pretty much, I'd say, guarantee a profit, but you probably have to put quite a lot of money in to win anything substantial back.
I mean, there was a poll out the other day in Wales in particular, which was quite startling, which showed Labour doing really, really well. Now, that may be a blip, that poll, and it does look a bit odd in some ways, but if they do as well as that poll is suggesting in Wales, then they won't lose any seats in Wales. In fact, they might even pick one or two up, incredibly. Mm. It's just about possible to imagine they might even win back one or two seats in Scotland. So if that happens, then the Tories are going to have to, you know, absolutely run the board in England for them to get the kind of numbers, the 200 majorities that you're talking about. So I can see where you're coming from there, yeah.
What are the most prominent political bets you're seeing being placed at the moment?
I mean, the amazing thing for me is that I expect there'll be lots of people having tens and £20 on Labour to get a majority and Corbyn to become Prime Minister. It's just the way of the world when you've got a very unbalanced market with a huge favourite. I wasn't really expecting people to be turning up with thousands of pounds on this, which is what is happening. So we're facing an enormous liability if we get a surprising result and Labour win most seats, or even worse, a majority, from a betting point of view anyway.
What, people are putting £1,000 bets on Corbyn to become Prime Minister?
Yeah, thousands of pounds. Well, he's down to about 8-1 with Ladbrokes now, which seems ridiculously short to me, but we're now in a situation where the liability we've got is so huge that our odds now are really just a reflection of that. So we can't really afford to take that much more money on Labour before we get to enormous numbers and I get told off by my bosses. So
Was the liability similar with Trump?
Yeah, well, in a way it was heading that way and we had to try and back out of it to try and make sure it wasn't too big, which actually worked out quite well, obviously, in the end. And we're in a similar situation now. So our prices now don't really have much to do with my opinion. Mm. They're just to do with us managing our potential big liabilities on Labour. So in actual fact, if there's any value, with people like Ladbrokes is probably taking the short prices about the Tories.
What do you think is the best bet to make this election?
I mean, the shrewdies are all backing the Liberal Democrats to do very, very badly, maybe to even lose ground from where they are at the moment with 9 seats. So everybody seems to think they're going to, you know, lose North Norfolk. They're not going to gain back many seats off the Tories. If I was having it, I think right now, I think the best bets are probably, there's a couple of Labour Liberal Democrat seats contests, which people had expected a few weeks ago, the Lib Dems would easily pick up Cambridge and Bermondsey. They're the two in my mind. From Labour, but actually now I'm starting to think that might not happen. So I think backing maybe Labour to win Cambridge at 2-1 seems like a good price right now, and I think they're about even money to win Bermondsey. They look like pretty good bets to me. Given the opinion polls right now, then they should win those seats.
I think the one I suggested in the piece, which I don't think Matthew agrees with, is that the Greens will win more than 2 seats. The price isn't great, I have to say, but I think they're going to do it.
Yeah, so it'd be a big surprise if they didn't win Brighton Pavilion. They've got a good shot in Bristol West, although Labour are slight favourites there. I myself can't see where the other win's going to come from. There's certainly no money for them to win those target seats in Norwich South, which they've done quite well in local elections there in the past. The other Bristol seats, Bath, I think they've mentioned the Isle of Wight. I don't know where that third seat's going to come from. I could see two, but
I mentioned the Isle of Wight, but you said they're now 50-1 to win that seat.
Yeah, the Tories are huge odds on favourite to retain that. So, you know, I would have thought that had they been making any progress there, we'd be taking a few bets on them. We're not. So I'm not saying that doesn't mean they can't win it, but no signs in the betting markets.
We should probably just talk about Eurovision quickly, because Freddie, you mentioned that in your piece, and actually on our Coffee House Shots podcast, our editor Fraser predicted the winner of this year's Eurovision, and stupidly didn't put any money on it.
This is where spectator intelligence really comes into its own.
Has that become a big thing, betting on Eurovision?
Yeah, it's huge. It's massive these days. It's easily the biggest sort of non-sports, non-political market we trade. We take there must be millions and millions of pounds being bet on this in the UK alone, never mind the rest of Europe. Yeah, Portugal, they went off favourites to the end, so I don't know if that's because Fraser tipped them or not, and everyone was following him in. And of course, they won by miles. It turned out to be a pretty good result for us because Eurovision people always tend to try and take a punt on the big outsiders at 50-1. I can't remember who sneaked into third place. Was it Moldova? Somebody like that, a big price. But otherwise, you know, Portugal went off favourite, so that worked out quite well for us.
Yeah, so I mean, I've got no idea about Eurovision, but I know next year I'll be following Fraser Nelson's tips on Coffee House Shots.
That was Freddie Gray and Matthew Shaddock. And to hear more from Freddie, subscribe to The Spectator's Americano podcast, which he hosts. That's all for this week. You can subscribe to the podcast on the iTunes store or by visiting spectator.co.uk/podcast. You can also subscribe to our other shows, including our books podcast, where this week Sam Leith discusses the 500th anniversary of the Reformation with historians Peter Stanford and Peter Marshall. And if you enjoy the podcast, why not pick up the magazine? You can read all the features discussed, as well as great pieces by DJ Taylor, Jenny McCartney and Christopher Buckley. And we have a trial offer. You can get 12 issues for just £12, including full digital access, and you'll also receive a limited edition Spectator Moleskine notebook worth £20. Just go to spectator.co.uk/pod offer. Thanks for listening, and do join us again next week.